Let's begin. As you can see, we're going to talk about the children of Israel this morning, and specifically when they came under Moses' leadership and they were coming out of the land of Egypt. God loved the children of Israel. He loved them so very much, but they were rebellious, and even throughout that rebellion, He was very patient with them. He gave them time to correct things. He brought them out of captivity in Egypt. If you remember, God had told Abraham way back in Genesis chapter 12 that He made him some promises. He told him that his descendants would become a great nation, that that great nation would inherit the land of Canaan, and that through Abraham's seed, all nations of the earth would be blessed. We know that it's talking about Jesus. So all of these promises have been made. Well, a couple chapters later in Genesis 15, He also tells Abraham that your descendants are going to be strangers in a foreign land. They're going to take them captive, and they're going to be there 400 years. That's talking about Egypt and their time in Egypt. And that's where we're going to pick up in Exodus chapter 3. In the days of Moses, Israel had become slaves. They were slaves to Pharaoh, and the Egyptians mistreated them terribly. Moses was the one chosen to be the man to lead Israel out of Egypt. In Exodus 3, verse 9, God speaking, and this is again there at the burning bush, which Mike read for us. "Now there, behold, the cry of the children of Israel has come to me, and I have also seen the oppression which the Egyptians oppressed them. Come now, therefore, and I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt." Moses resisted at first, but then he finally realized that God wasn't asking. God was telling him He was going to be the man who would take them out of Egypt. And so Moses and his brother Aaron, they set out to free Israel as God commanded. The children of Israel struggle with their faith during this time. And I think we can see a lot of ourselves in them. We're going to look at three different ways that they struggled. And hopefully we can learn some lessons from their mistakes, the problems that they had. Let's start with this. Go ahead and turn to Exodus 4. When Moses and Aaron first came to Israel, we may forget about this. The first time they came, Israel was excited. When they first had it revealed to them that God was going to save them, Israel liked this idea. Go to Exodus 4. Look at verse 29. "Then Moses and Aaron went and gathered together all the elders of the children of Israel. And Aaron spoke all the words which the Lord had spoken to Moses. Then he did the signs in the sight of the people." He had given Aaron the ability to perform some miraculous signs to convince the people that these things were true, that they had truly been sent by God. But look at the reply, verse 31. "So the people believed. And when they heard that the Lord had visited the children of Israel, that He looked out on their affliction, they bowed their heads and worshiped." What are they? They are thrilled. God has seen our affliction. He's going to free us. God is going to save us. And they're excited about it. But then Moses and Aaron go to Pharaoh. And they tell Pharaoh, "You need to let the people go out into the wilderness 3 days' journey and worship unto their God." Well, Pharaoh doesn't take that so well. He starts looking around and says, "I see what the problem here is. These people don't have enough work to do. Idol. These Israelites, these Hebrews are idle. Well, I tell you what we'll do. We used to supply you guys with straw that you could mix with your bricks. We're not giving you straw anymore. You go get your own straw. But we're requiring the same number of bricks from you as before." So they put this additional burden. And they are harsh toward the children of Israel. Now remember, when Moses first came to them, the children of Israel said, "This is great. This is wonderful. We'll bow down and worship. We're going to be saved." Notice their reaction after Pharaoh oppresses them. This is in chapter 5, verse 20. "Then as they came out from Pharaoh, they met Moses and Aaron, who stood there to meet them. And they said, 'Let the Lord look on you and judge, because you have made us abhorrent in the sight of Pharaoh and in the sight of his servants, to put a sword in their hand to kill us.'" But they're not happy anymore. They're not excited about this anymore. And actually, they're being dishonest with themselves. They make it seem like Moses and Aaron made Pharaoh hate them. He already hated them. They were already slaves and oppressed. What happened, though? What happened between chapter 4, verse 29, 31, and chapter 5? I think the problem is, because they're blaming Moses now, they didn't think this salvation was going to cost them anything. They thought God was just going to miraculously take care of it. Maybe He would use Moses and Aaron, and we're going to sit by on the sidelines and just hang out and then everything's going to be fine. We'll just blink our eyes and salvation will be here. They didn't think they were going to have to get involved. That's not true. Salvation for them was going to be a spectator sport, they seem to think. It's not true for them. It's not true for you and me. Let's consider some things. Being a disciple takes some serious effort. Jesus said, "And whoever does not bear his cross and come after me cannot be my disciple." Does it require some effort? Absolutely does. 1 Thessalonians 1, verse 3. Remembering without ceasing your work of faith, your labor of love, and the patience of hope in our Lord Jesus Christ. Sounds like work to me. Sounds like some serious effort is expected by God of His people. Matthew 9. Mark your places in Exodus. We'll be back. But Matthew 9. Notice how throughout the New Testament, the faithful are referred to as laborers. This is a section that I imagine you're very familiar with. Matthew 9, verses 37 and 38. Jesus speaking, "Then he said to his disciples, 'The harvest truly is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore pray the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into his harvest.'" Again, the disciples, those faithful, referred to as laborers. It's going to take some effort. And he's always let us know that. He's been very upfront and clear about that. There may be a temptation to sit back and let somebody else do all the work in the kingdom. But it's never worked. It didn't work for Israel during their time. It won't work for us today either. Something else we need to understand. When we take God's side, it will upset the world. There's no way around this. When you choose your loyalty, understand everything that comes with it. Taking his side means upsetting the world. Pharaoh was furious when God's people chose God's side instead of Pharaoh's. Same thing will happen today. Paul, writing to Timothy, says, "Yes, and all who desire to live godly in Christ Jesus will suffer persecution." So this is from Paul. Peter says something very similar. I love the way he words it. "Beloved, do not think it strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you, as though some strange thing happened to you. When hard times come, when persecution comes, because you did what God wanted, don't think it's weird. That's the way it is. That's the way it's always been, because the world does not like that stuff. The world is not in harmony with God, and therefore when you choose God's ways, you're going to make some people mad. That's the way it has always been." The children of Israel, they seem to think they could have all the benefits without getting involved. Just not the case. You remember, Paul told the Philippians, "Work out your own salvation with fear and trembling." Obviously, the grace comes from God. The power of salvation comes through Christ's blood. That is all His. But He has given us a role to play, and He expects us to be busy about playing it. Faith has never been a spectator sport. Turn to Hebrews 11. Just want to look at something real quickly. You can look at this in more detail this afternoon. I'm not going to go through the whole chapter, but I want to make a point from Hebrews chapter 11. Again, faith not being a spectator sport. Look at these. Hebrews chapter 11. You could refer to it as the hall of the faithful if you want to. It would certainly be a fair description. Look at verse 4. "By faith, Abel offered to God a more excellent sacrifice." Go down to verse 6. Let's see. Verse 7. "By faith, Noah, being divinely warned of things not yet seen, moved with godly fear, prepared an ark." By faith, verse 8, "Abraham obeyed when he was called." What do you see? And you're going to see it throughout the whole chapter, chapter 11. Faith led them to do what God said. Faith was always a doing faith with these who were considered faithful. It's the same thing for you and me. If our faith is alive, it will be evidenced by our actions and by our involvement. Another thing I think we can see from Israel. When they took their eyes off of God and they took their eyes off of the prize of Canaan, they got into trouble every single time. They often fell into complaining, and it's just kind of incredible when you look at it. God brought them out of Egypt and provided for them as they traveled through the wilderness. You remember that, all the things He had done for them. Turn to Exodus 14. "He parted the Red Sea for them, which is one of those miracles that everybody knows. I mean, this is something that everybody's familiar with. My family was not very religious. I didn't know much about the Bible growing up, but I knew about what Moses did at the Red Sea. I at least had that one. This is so well known. It's so powerful. The scope of it, you get to see God's power there. He parts the sea so they can cross over on dry ground. This is Exodus 14. Look at 21. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night. And he made the sea into dry land, and the waters were divided. So the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea on the dry ground, and the waters were a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. I just want to make one point when you read this. They crossed over on dry ground. They didn't cross over on muddy ground. And I simply point that out to show the completion of this miracle. God had thought of everything. And he didn't just move the water. He sucked all the water out. They were able to cross over with all of these children and with all of their belongings that they had basically looted Egypt on the way out on dry ground. He did this for them. And then when their enemies chased them into the midst of it, he causes the waters to return. And the greatest army on earth at that time, Egypt, is crushed beneath the waters of the Red Sea. Does that get your attention? Would that have gotten your attention if you had been there? What great things he had done for these who he considered his people, even though they haven't actually made the covenant with him yet. They would in chapter 19. But he loved them and he provided for them. He'd done so much for them. Even after that, it wasn't long before they started complaining. That happens in chapter 14. Chapter 15, they're complaining because the water they come up to is bitter. So God takes care of it. He makes it sweet for them. Well, in chapter 16, they complain that they don't have a food that they want. So he provides manna miraculously to come down and feed them. He's going to do that for 40 years and take care of them while they're out in the wilderness. Well, by the time we get to Exodus 17, they're complaining about water again. And again, in Numbers 20. And in Numbers 11, the manna that God had miraculously provided for them to take care of them in the wilderness for 40 years. Yeah, guess what? We don't like that manna. We're sick of it. They complained about everything. Everything that he had done for them. He saves them out of the hand of Pharaoh. He provides a pillar of the cloud during the day to guide them. And at night, it's a pillar of fire to guide them and go before them. Everywhere that they go, he provides for the water they need. He provides for the food they need. He provides everything. He's going to, at Sinai, make them his special people, and yet they still complain. Here's the thing. Did they not think he was going to take care of them? You know, when you part the Red Sea and you destroy Egypt on behalf of these people, do you really think he's going to let you starve? If he can do that, can he feed me and take care of my thirst? Of course he can. We do the same thing now. We look at this list and we say, oh, Israel, what's wrong with you people? Well, you just can't see the good that God did. I do the same thing. When we complain like that, we doubt God. And it's a lack of being thankful to Him for what He's done. I come from a family of complainers. I do. That's how we dealt with things growing up. When things went bad, we griped. That's how we took care of it. And we excused it because we said, well, you know, I got to get it off my chest. It makes me feel better when I... But it didn't. All it ever did was make me madder and keep me madder for longer. It never took care of the problem. Why? Why do we complain so much? Because we didn't appreciate what God had done for us. We had a lot of blessings in my home growing up. We missed them because we were too busy griping about the other stuff. What a shame. Complaining does not deal with the problem. It just stacks bitterness on top of the problem. You still got the problem, and now you got bitterness on top of it. It is dangerous. It was dangerous for Israel, and it is for us too. We start down that path, we'll look at everything except the blessings that God has given to us. I want you to turn to Luke 9. It's so easy to do. It's so easy to look everywhere else and look around at what I think I'm lacking. What I think I'm missing. Maybe I used to have it, but I don't anymore. It's so easy to look out there and forget to see what I have right in front of me. What God is blessing me with. Luke 9. Verse 62. But Jesus said to him, "No one, having put his hand to the plow and looking back, is fit for the kingdom of God." When we take our hands off, and we use this example in Bible classes, when you're driving a plow, as long as you're looking ahead, the plow goes straight. What happens when you turn and look over your shoulder behind you? Well, now the plow goes off. Focus on what you're doing. Look at those things that we have before us. Turn to Numbers 11. Consider Israel again. Numbers chapter 11. He had brought Israel out of physical bondage. He has brought Christians out of spiritual bondage to sin. Don't look back longingly at that old life, Christian. Sometimes we get caught up in that. We look back and we think, well, you know, I missed this and I missed that. Don't do it. You can't move forward if you're looking back. Numbers 11 is one of those verses. Verse 4 is really in 5 where I wanted to start. The children of Israel began weeping. And they say, "Who will give us meat to eat?" Look at verse 5. "For we remember the fish which we ate freely in Egypt, and the cucumbers, and the melons, and the leeks, and the onions, and the garlic. But now our whole being is dried up. There's nothing at all except this manna before our eyes." They look back at Egypt. They thought, man, the cucumbers, and the melons, and the onions, and the leeks, and the garlic, they're so great. Do you notice that they're leaving something out here about Egypt? What did they forget? They were slaves in Egypt. They're talking about it like it was a vacation. Oh, Egypt, those Egyptians got it so good. You were slaves. They beat you. They hated you. And then they put quotas on you that you couldn't possibly fulfill. And what are you doing? Looking back saying, oh man, I wish we were there. Why did we come out here? We can do it too. We can just get caught up and look at what the world has to offer and forget what God has done for us. When that happens, because it will, because it'll be a temptation for us. When we feel that coming on, here's what we can do. Count your blessings. And I don't mean just in a general, I mean literally. And if you need a piece of paper and a pen, then do it. When you feel overwhelmed, and you feel like I'm just complaining about this stuff, write down what God has done for you and see what that list comes to. And it's going to be different for a lot of us. It may be that you have parents who taught you the truth of the gospel from the moment you were born. Is that a blessing? It absolutely is. It may be a spouse who loves you and wants what's best for you. It may be children. If you're a Christian in this room, you do have brethren who want you to go to heaven. They love you, and they will do what they can to help you. That is one. Put that on your list if you're a member of the Lord's church, because you have that. This is one thing everybody has, Christian or not. Romans 5, verse 6. "For when we were still without strength, in due time Christ died for the ungodly." He gave that to me. And bless me with that. Regardless if I obey Him or not, He still sent His Son to die. Who deserves that? And yet He gave it to me. And when I think of that, how in the world can I complain? When the Prince of Heaven left, took on flesh, and died for me, how can I complain? What great things have been done for me. One other issue the children of Israel had was their mouths. This is a quote from James 3, verse 6. "The tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity." And Lord willing, we'll be studying that in James in the next few lessons. Tongue is dangerous. Dangerous member of our body. And James points this out. It's a little member, but boy, he can set some forest fires when he gets going. Israel could not control their tongues. Turn to number 16. Should be just a few pages away. Or a few clicks away. Or swipes away. Whatever it is, you should be close. Israel's problem, their hearts were wrong. And so their words showed it. Korah, Dathan, and Abiram slander Moses and Aaron in Numbers 16. Let's think about it. Let's read the first three verses. "Now Korah, the son of Izhar, son of Kohath, son of Levi, with Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, and On, the son of Peleth, the sons of Reuben, took men. And they rose up before Moses with some of the children of Israel, 250 leaders of the congregation, representatives of the congregation, men of renown. And they gathered together against Moses and Aaron and said to them, "You take too much upon yourselves, for all the congregation is holy, every one of them, and the Lord is among them. Why then do you exalt yourselves above the assembly of the Lord?" This is slander, and this is why. They are making it sound as though Moses and Aaron have taken this leadership for themselves, as though they walked out and said, we're going to lead this group. We will make ourselves princes and rule over this group. Is that what happened? Moses tried to get out of it. In Exodus 4, he tried every excuse he could think of to get out of doing this. Moses didn't want the job. God is the one who put them in that position. That's not the way that Korah and his friends make it sound. They begin slandering them through this speech. They're going to cost themselves their lives and 250 other men as well. Now, I say that because the Bible has a lot to say about us guarding our tongues. Matthew 12, verse 34, the last part of that verse says, "For out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks." Whatever comes out of my mouth, those words were developed in my heart. It started there. If something nasty and hateful comes out of my mouth, I created it in my heart. Where it originated. My mouth is just the tool by which it's being spread. It started in my heart. This is Jesus speaking here. Proverbs 13. "He who guards his mouth preserves his life, but he who opens wide his lips shall have destruction." It speaks for itself. Guard what you say. Be careful about when you open that gate. There's a lot of dangerous things that can come out of that thing. And it can reflect back and lead to destruction. Ephesians, this is Paul writing to the saints at Ephesus, "Let no corrupt word proceed out of your mouth, but what is good for necessary edification, that it might impart grace to the hearers." Do I do that? When I say something, do I think ahead of time, is this going to impart grace to the people who hear it? Do I just stop and consider what I'm about to say before I say it? Or do I just knee-jerk and spit that stuff out and think, "Ooh, maybe that was probably not the wisest choice"? God expects His people to think before we speak. So one more with it. Proverbs 15:28. "The heart of the righteous studies how to answer, but the mouth of the wicked pours forth evil." You know what the word "study" means. It's more than 10 seconds. You study for 10 seconds, it'll be a rough test, right? It's not going to go well. You know what study means. You take time. You weigh it. And you consider it. You look at it from all these different angles to make sure you have it. He says, "That's what I need to do with my words." Do I do that? Or am I really, really awful at this? Where do my words come from? When I talk to my spouse, when I talk to my kids, when I talk to my parents, if they are nasty and hateful, so is my heart. That's the connection I need to make. I need to fix it. Those words aren't coming from thin air. They're coming from somewhere. They're coming from inside. Let's talk about gossip and slander for a little bit. Our world loves this stuff. It eats it up. It loves to tell something about somebody or hear something about somebody. Just go to Walmart and see what's in the magazine rack if you don't believe it. And the websites that are dedicated to TMZ, I mean, this stuff, the world loves it. It's entertained by it. Gossip is spreading stories that have not been verified. Slander is when you maliciously say false things that could damage somebody's reputation. I do want to say this, though. Simply talking about somebody who is not present is not necessarily wrong. I think somebody get the idea that if someone's not there and you talk about them, it's wrong. It's not wrong. You can say good things about people who aren't there. Mike made the announcements this morning. He told us about Albertina. She's not here. Was that sinful? Well, no. He's telling us so we can be praying about her and know what's going on. The intent behind it says a whole lot. Here's one more, and stay with me, because when I first say this, you're going to be tempted to disagree. Even saying negative things about someone is not necessarily wrong. Hang on. Did Jesus ever say anything negative about anybody? You ever say anything negative about scribes and Pharisees? He did. Well, what was the intent behind it? Because they were dangerous. And they were teaching people false doctrine. And he wanted to warn those people. Was he concerned about the souls of the scribes and Pharisees? He was. But they were also dangerous. And so he warned people. Paul specifically names Hymenaeus and Philetus to Timothy. Watch out. They teach false doctrine. Stay away from them. The intent behind it was to warn others. But let's think of some examples of sinful slander. Turn to Proverbs 24. Verse 28. Spreading false reports about someone would certainly qualify as this, whether intentional or not. Here's the thing. I don't need to jump to conclusions. Before I open my mouth, can I honestly say, I know this is true? When I'm about to say, I know this is absolutely true. Or am I just saying stuff? Do I verify it to make sure that it's right? Do I investigate and get the whole story? Proverbs 24, verse 28. Do not be a witness against your neighbor without cause. Make sure that you know the reason is just. If something's wrong, it needs to be addressed. But I need to make sure I have the facts. So here's the thing. Here's the question, I guess. What is my motivation for saying whatever it is? When I open my mouth, why am I saying it? People often say things to do others harm, to belittle them, to make themselves look better. Here are some inappropriate reasons to open my mouth. Turn to 1 Peter 2. When I open my mouth to speak, is it because of anger or because I'm looking for an opportunity to get back at someone for something? You ever been hurt? Somebody said something bad about you, upset you, and then something happens and you get an opportunity to return the favor. You got something on them now and you say, all right, yeah, guess whose turn it is now? Compare this to what Jesus did. 1 Peter 2, look at verse 22. Let's start with 21. For to this you were called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that you should follow his steps. Peter, very clear, this is what Jesus did. And he's to be our example. We're to do the same. Verse 22, who committed no sin, nor was deceit found in his mouth. Verse 23 is what I want us to focus on. Who, when he was reviled, did not revile in return. And when he suffered, he did not threaten, but committed himself to him who judges righteously. Did they badmouth him? Oh, they did. Could he have just been nasty and slandered them and burned them down? But he didn't. He's my example. Is he my example? He's supposed to be. Do I model my actions after what he did? Another inappropriate reason for speaking can be envy. Still in 1 Peter 2, back in verse 1. Therefore, laying aside all malice, all deceit, hypocrisy, envy, and all evil speaking, lay it by, lay it aside. This doesn't have any part, any place in the Christian's life. We might talk badly about others because we're jealous. We want to make them look bad, to make ourselves look better. That's selfish, and it's petty, and it's unloving. It's not at all like my Christ, my Lord, and his example. 2 Thessalonians chapter 3. Fortunately, I think this one's probably all too true. What is my motivation for saying this? It may be because I just like meddling. I just like stirring up trouble. Unfortunately, that's the cause behind a lot of ill-spoken words. 2 Thessalonians 3, verse 11. For we hear that there are some who walk among you in a disorderly manner, not working at all, but are busybodies. They are up in everybody's business because they get a thrill from spreading dirt about other people. It entertains them. If I know somebody's in a bad situation, my desire ought to be to help them. Not stir up stuff. Not spread dirt about them. If I love them like I should, I'll try to do what's right. I'll try to do right by them. This goes completely against that. Matthew 18. And certainly there are more than this, but these four really stand out to me. And these are issues that as Christians we can really struggle with. If someone has done me wrong, in Matthew 18, what is the command? Go to them and take care of it. Don't go to everybody else. Now that, granted, This is a progress. If you go to the one and they will not hear you, then take others with you and go. And if they will not hear you after that, then take it to the church. I understand it and you do as well. But what's the first step? When it's between you and me, I need to go to you. Because if we handle it there, it goes no further. It's gone. It's taken care of. But what is the usual reaction? Go yell it from the rooftops. It was between you and me, and now everybody knows. See, Jesus, if we would just follow His pattern, we could save ourselves a lot of trouble. And save the church a lot of pain. Why did Korah speak slanderously of Moses and Aaron? You remember? Back in Numbers 16. Answers in verse 10 there. He wasn't content with his position. He wanted theirs. It was his jealousy that made him say those things. And he ends up costing himself, his family, and 250 other men their lives because he spoke with a wicked heart. Consider these things before we speak. Do I have this person's good in mind? Do I have their best interest in mind with what I'm about to say? I think if we follow these, it'll save us a whole lot of missteps in this. If they heard me say it, would it be obvious to them that I love them? I'm supposed to love them. My God expects me to love them. Would they know when they hear what I have to say about them that I truly do? Here's a big one. Am I praying for them? Because it's very difficult to slander somebody while you are praying for their good. Impossible. Am I praying for them? All of these things, can I consider that before I say anything about someone else? If I find myself speaking ill of you or to you, I need to ask myself why. What is it that's causing this? If you're in sin, then I need to go to you. I need to talk to you, not about you. And you need to do the same for me. If I'm angry toward you, I need to go to you and make it right. If I'm jealous or something like that, I need to seek forgiveness and be happy for you. Sitting around speaking ill of others is never an option given to Christians. We're given a lot of options. There are a lot of things we can do. We can go to each other and build each other up. We can encourage each other. We can just sit next to each other. We can tell others to come with us to encourage. We can do a lot of stuff, but sitting around bad-mouthing people is never an option given to us. Man, Israel struggled. They struggled along the way. They struggled because they weren't ready to show their own faith. They weren't ready for the persecution that would come. Real faith is shown by our actions. And they struggled because they complained and they ignored all the good things that God had done for them. I need to focus on the good that He's done for me. And finally, they struggled because their evil words were a reflection of their evil hearts. When I love God and the people around me like I should, my words will be right. They won't have a choice but to be right. Because they'll come out of the treasure of a good heart instead of an evil one. Where's your heart this morning? Go get your songbooks out. We mentioned this earlier. The Prince of Heaven died for us.